Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you are in the 48 lower states. This is Michael Vandervoort, and it is May 14th, and we're doing a daytime show for the first time in a while. Our guest today is Katie Zink. Katie, welcome to Drive Through HR. It's morning for you because you're in Portland. So what's going on in Portland?
Hey there, Michael. There might be an echo happening. Are you hearing this?
You're fine on my end. And you, yeah. Let's just keep going. Are you getting echo in your connection?
It's repeating itself for me on my end. Let's see if it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It'll be confusing for you, but it's not in the recording. So let's just go on. Okay. Katie.
Hey there, Michael. Can you hear me?
I can. Yeah. Go ahead and tell folks who you are and what you do.
Awesome. Sorry about that. I think I figured out what was going on. Yeah, it's my pleasure to join you today. It's morning for me. I'm over on the West Coast in Portland, Oregon. And I am here to talk today about elevating organizational inclusion, equity, and diversity. And you've been so kind to allow me to join this week. So a little bit about me. Right now, I'm focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion strategy, helping companies build their plans to put in place once they're ready to make the commitment. So we'll kind of get a little bit into this later, I imagine, but I like to open up with DEI work as sort of being on a spectrum. It can look many, many different ways for many different companies, and it's very context dependent. And so that informs a lot of my work. Ultimately, my goal, though, is to help them put this plan in place so they can create positive and a dynamic culture that hears, recognizes, and supports all voices in the organization. And in my work, I talk a lot about collective success. You can see on my website that I start off saying, you know, I focus on strategies for collective inclusion because I believe that that's true organizational effectiveness. So my background ranges from work in the hospitality world to education, and I've worked at a various amount of tech companies here in Portland. Most recently, I was working at an ed tech company where we delivered a digital literacy curriculum teaching students from grades K to 8 digital skills. So I was working in the client success side of things, and then I transitioned over to the marketing communications department, focusing on, you know, that external communication. And then about 2 years ago, I stepped into the chair position of a diversity and inclusion committee that one of our employees started right around 2017, right after the election. And I was a member of the committee for a year. It was a really frustrating time, though. We didn't feel very productive. We didn't have a plan. We were kind of just project managing our way through this work and trying to understand it at the same time. And so about a year later, I decided, you know, I actually feel pretty confident discussing these issues. I think I can have an impact. You know, my education is in women and gender studies, and I've completed a lot of coursework in racial studies, ethnic studies. So, you know, I love talking about this stuff, and I feel like I can really help. So I ended up stepping in to the leadership role of this voluntary committee. And for the last 2 years of my time there, I led the committee. And I absolutely loved it. It was the most rewarding part of my job. And so about a year ago, I realized, you know, I have this entrepreneurial kind of I feel very entrepreneurial. I feel like I want to explore this in my career. And I feel like right now, especially in Portland, this work is gaining a lot of traction. A lot of organizations are realizing how important it is to have a visible commitment to diversity. So about 2 years ago, I decided that's what I was going to do. And I, you know, created my business, and I've now launched a signature consulting program, and it's called the Collective Culture Model. And so that's where I actually kind of step in as their strategist and guide their way through creating their first year strategic plan for their very first, you know, commitment to this initiative. And because what I've found is that more and more companies know it's important. It's not really having to sell understanding what it is or that they need it. They know it is important and they want to show this and demonstrate this. They just don't know what to do. And so, you know, it's helpful for me to step in as kind of a third party or an objective lens and guide them in a very structured, you know, familiar way. It's strategic planning, which many of us, you know, do regularly. And so that's really the meat of my program. It's a 3-month program, and by the templatized, scalable plan that's built for action. And ideally, it's very representative of the whole organization. We've got, you know, executive sponsors involved and stakeholders from all the departments. And so ideally, we will work towards collective success for everybody in the company.
Okay. I have a couple short questions. And then, so the first one is, I found it interesting, and it seems like these things grow. So you use DEI versus just diversity or just inclusion or D&I, which you see a lot. So you've included equity. And I mean, that makes sense, but how did you decide to describe, you know, kind of the summary of your practice as diversity, equity, and inclusion, and how are they different?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. And, you know, that question comes up a lot because, you know, with many different acronyms popping up all over the place and, you know, different terminologies, this work kind of requires a strong command of a ton of different evolving language. And so you'll hear, you know, some practitioners even start with EDI or the with IDE, or even, you know, I've seen JEDI, I've seen JEDI out there to include justice, and I've seen DIBS to include diversity, inclusion, and belonging. So kind of what I mentioned earlier, that it's very context specific to what that organization is striving for. I definitely am guilty of kind of using a lot of different ways to reference it. So to your question about equity, and I can reference one of my favorite thought leaders who lives here in Portland, who has a fabulous TED talk about why equity needs to be in the work. Because you can think about it this way. Diversity is being invited to the party, but inclusion is being asked to dance. So equity is then the third component where we need to have holistic consideration for everyone where they are in their life. We need to be meeting people where they are if we're to solve for every issue. We need to be centering those who have been the most historically marginalized, you know, in their work, in their experience, in their day-to-day, and also generationally. So equity just really gives a nod to, you know, yes, equality. It's a little bit like equality, but it's even more specific to the fact of centering people who have been the most marginalized, needing that support, because the outcome will be that everybody benefits. And so you'll see equity come up a lot more as actually the most important component of this work, whereas the yes, that's what we're all here to achieve, but we can't really do that authentically without a focus on equity work.
Yeah. And you also use on your website a lot the term actionable DEI. Is that a definitional thing for you? Or, you know, I guess, if, you know, you would think DEI should be actionable anywhere, right? But maybe not, because some companies don't get it. How did you come on that idea? And what does that represent for you in terms of your practice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my message that I'm really trying to get in front of people is why strategic equals actionable. And that might seem like a completely obvious thing to say, but I've seen a lot of companies kind of take this check-the-box approach. They will try to do kind of some one-off or fragmented efforts to show that they're committed. And all that, you know, I fully believe is in good faith, but it's not really gospel, and it's not an effort that everyone in the organization will be on the same page on and be able to articulate equally. And so I'm very much of the belief that before any doing or acting, there really needs to be common ground and total understanding of what's needed in that context. And so many of us, you know, are wired to want to take action often well before we really understand what we need to do. So this really calls for like an immersion of self-education, you know, individuals really going deep and getting real with, you know, coming to terms with some of their own privileges and some of their own experiences and inherent and unconscious biases that we all have. So that work really needs to happen first before we can just, you know, do these grand, you know, gestures of this work, because it just won't come across as authentic. But of course, action is what needs to happen in the end result. So I guess when I say actionable, I mean, there just really needs to be an intentional plan, and there needs to be data to prove what's needed in the organization first. And there needs to be, you know, involvement from everyone in the organization. It's an organization-wide effort. And some of the myths that I hear are that it should, you know, you're an HR practitioner, you know, our listeners are, it probably is falling on their shoulders right now in their individual companies. And I'm of the belief that that's really not fair. I mean, it's a lot of people that are flexing their skills and involved in this work clearly already have full-time jobs. And so it kind of is everybody's job. It's not one person's job. And so my program kind of steps everybody through, you know, bite-sized actions they can all take. But ultimately, there really needs to be, you know, clarity on what are the problems we're trying to solve and how. And then, you know, even before that, it's just getting really observant. You know, I write a lot about this, is how to start noticing what's going on at work and how to use that, you know, what I call DEI lens or equity lens is used a lot in the space, approaching everything you do with that lens. And then once you kind of get comfortable doing that on a regular basis, little actions will emerge that you can take. You know, being an effective ally is an amazing action that people can start becoming more comfortable doing. Becoming more culturally competent is, I think, I mean, that's a massive skill to learn if you're new to it. You know, that would be a fantastic action folks can take. You know, but ultimately, I think getting immersed in it, self-educating, is the best first action one can take. And, you know, develop those skills around empathy and develop active listening skills, you know, spur conversation with folks on these subjects, but really just try to, you know, quiet your mind and be present and listen during the conversations. And you'll probably learn something. You'll probably learn an action just from that one conversation that you can take.
Awesome. This is like every time I talk to somebody that does what you do as kind of their main HR related, you know, skill set, this question comes up in my mind, and that is that diversity and inclusion, you know, it's been through all kinds of iterations, and like yours with DEI, you know, seems like another one, and you could equate that to LGBTQ, where they, you know, now it's LGBTQIA, you know, it just kind of keeps growing to encompass more and more. And all this stuff is aspirationally great for an organization and for individuals. And many companies strive to drive, you know, these efforts. And yet our society, like, and I'm, you know, I'm going to drag in the news, like, a little bit. Our society struggles with this. And it's the individuals. I mean, there's groups, and clearly I don't want to get into politics, but you know, we've got like the people who want everyone to wear masks versus people who are, you know, somehow a mask is an extreme violation of their civil liberties, which I don't get, but a lot of people seem to be on that bandwagon. And then we've had, you know, the shootings of folks in Ahmaud Arbery and others, you know, just in the news this week, and Amy Stevens, who was involved in a case at the Supreme Court, and I don't think they've ruled yet, about transgender issues in the workplace. There's a lot of stuff in the news where we don't deal with this stuff well as individuals. You mentioned empathy. How does an organization aspire to do this kind of really good work and yet deal with all these kind of, you know, individual biases and opinions and stuff? How do you help them with that?
Yes. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that we're all still kind of writing the narrative of what to do from here, you know, with COVID related stuff, with the violence that's happening still, and everyone, you know, kind of works through this and copes individually for sure. And, you know, as an organization, you want to do what's best for the company. You want to do, you know, what's best for the collective good. And, you know, I talk a lot about prioritizing people over profit. And I was interviewing a friend of mine recently who, you know, we talked about how to unify amongst difference. And it felt like a very big question to tackle. But I think that what you said, I loved how you bring up distinction between individual and collective. Is, you know, my program, the Collective Culture Model, is sort of inspired by this distinction, because they're neither are better than the other. Neither is wrong. Neither is right. I mean, it's important to have individualism. It's important to have collectivism. I designed my program to honor the good of the group, the collective best, the collective success. And so, you know, we're all going through this thing right now. None of us can ignore this. We're all trying to cope and stay sane, you know, with these different crises popping up, feels like every day almost. And so we're trying to ensure our foundational needs are met. We're trying to ensure our civil liberties are met, and everyone's kind of defining that differently. And, you know, we're no stranger to kind of feeling divided oftentimes. And yes, don't want to dive too deeply into politics, but thinking about, you know, the collective strategies to protect all of us, I think is how decisions need to be made. You know, folks that feel like I shouldn't have to wear a mask, you know, I don't feel symptomatic, I don't feel this way, this doesn't apply to me. You know, unfortunately, I just feel like that's what's holding back moving forward, because, you know, social distancing, for example, is a tactic honoring collective over the individual. We all have to take these steps together in order to see growth and improvement. In Oregon, I'm grateful to say I really trust our governor, that she's extended our lockdown, you know, well into the summer. We're looking at July, I think, for now. And I was just talking with a colleague of mine in Ohio who's just like, oh, I'm afraid. Like, I don't want to, I'm not going to leave my house, even though businesses are opening, you know, and that's her individual choice, because she's honoring the collective. So I hope that answers the question. Is that just, it kind of brings up how do we unify amongst difference? How do we find that common ground? And I hope that COVID, we learn that, you know, this is impacting everybody differently. It's kind of shedding light and highlighting, you know, lots of inequities and lots of injustices we maybe weren't previously aware of. I hope that it still has the potential to unify us and help us understand each other better, because we're just trying to make these decisions that help everybody collectively, and we're centering the most at risk, that's why we're doing this. That's why we're sheltering in place. We're protecting this marginalized group who's at risk now. And hopefully, you know, many governors, I think, are still centering people over profit. You know, you hear a lot of other, you know, mayors and governors that want to open. And of course, we all want to go back to work. Of course, we're all trying to stay sane, and not being able to go into work has been tough for everybody. But they don't have a plan for the safety of the people. So I just keep going back to the fact that we have to stay collective minded right now during this time.
Yeah, and it's difficult, and, you know, and I think that reflects back into, like, you know, the famous statement for D&I is, you know, come to work and be your whole authentic self. And frankly, when individuals show up, you know, right now, sometimes their whole authentic selves aren't that appealing or aren't that helpful, you know. So I don't know that we'll ever crack this, and I know there's not one answer to that question, but it's definitely something that, I guess organizations, you know, with employment and that kind of thing, there are some group norm kind of things that employers can kind of sort of demand, or maybe not demand, but more rather have expectations about how people conduct themselves in the workplace. But like, I just saw a video the other day that I couldn't believe, where on Mother's Day, it was at a Red Lobster somewhere on the East Coast, and a customer was like attacking, and there was a customer and a worker from the Red Lobster two women, and they were like not beating the crap out of each other, but they were shoving each other. And the, you know, it was like a 5-minute display, you know, F bombs flying around, and, you know, over Mother's Day food, right? The one day of the year, where, you know, one of the days of the year we should all be being nice to each other. These two ladies were going to beat the crap. And it turned into a brawl for, you know,
wow.
Waiting for food.
Yeah.
Had nothing to do with DE&I, but I mean, you know, like in some cases, this stuff brings out the worst, I guess. So that's not really what we were here to talk about, though. But it just seems like it's such an ongoing problem that it, you know, what you do is always going to have some difficulty in the organization. And hopefully, you know, the ones that are successful, I guess, norm some of this stuff out to where they do the best they can.
I might jump in quickly. I would say, what you bring up is interesting. I would connect it to equity and inclusion work, because I think sometimes in times of stress, in times of like not feeling like we have what we need, we act out, and we, you know, our deepest biases, our deepest kind of like conflictive traits, kind of rear their ugly head, and people are kind of reactionary right now. And I feel like I would definitely tie that into how people treat each other at work. You know, it's a high stress environment. You're trying to get things done efficiently and productively. And so our brain kind of goes to that zone of, you know, trying to maybe going into that stereotyping mode, maybe just relying on your inherent biases or, you know, coherent biases to make decisions quickly. So, I think that's actually a really smart tie-in.
You know, things like, you know, I've seen some accounts online where people, you know, wear a mask, and you know, some of their colleagues, you know, their coworkers kind of shame them, you know, mass shaming, I guess, you know, and we hear about all kinds of shaming, right? And it's just, you know, we just seems like a lot of times we go to the bad side at times, and, you know, we struggle to be better. You mentioned COVID-19 a couple times, I guess. How has it affected your business and kind of the work you do? Has there been I'm sure there's a direct impact, but what does it look like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been interesting. I've definitely had to do some pivoting in my approach. I feel very comfortable working virtually. I've worked from home for quite some time, so that wasn't a challenging shift for me. And my program can be completely delivered virtually. And so I am, you know, willing to work for sure, and open to new clients. A lot of clients of my peers out there and other D&I practitioners, you know, they're not going to be doing a lot of workshopping or a lot of kind of their regular efforts that they were kind of in the midst of, because we've kind of made this like upheaval to survival mode. It's unfortunately been a challenge to justify spending time with this stuff. And so, you know, a lot of D&I practitioners are out there saying this is the most important time to not let this stuff go on the back burner. But I was talking with, you know, a client of mine and a good friend of mine. She says it feels like it's pulling teeth. You know, their strategy is to meet quarterly, and it was a kind of a coalition or a committee that I helped build. Right now they're down to about 4 people attending. So it's just hard to like assign things out, get the work done. They have some sort of, they have a really nice amount of like sustaining programs and employee resource groups that I help them build that are, running really easily because they're already in place. But, you know, bringing in outside speakers is challenging right now. You know, companies aren't going to be bringing in outside consultants, you know, I don't know when, honestly. But, you know, resources and policies and practices, this is a really good time to revisit those things. So my client was able to just roll out a brand new hiring manager kind of document to help with structured interviewing, structured hiring practices, you know, to lend themselves to equitable hiring practices. They're on a hiring freeze, but that actually maybe is a good time for them to take a breath and be proactive about creating these resources. So there's a lot of stuff that we can definitely keep doing. It just might look a little bit differently. So I have a role model that told me, you know, as long as you stay true to your point of view, just know that your method of delivery will change. and this is like a perfect time to, this is just like, yep, this is that time now. Virtual events are becoming the norm already very quickly. So for me, I'm feeling optimistic still. I'm feeling like this is a really good time to build relationships and be there for people, you know, and just hear what they're going through, because, you know, we don't have a manual for this stuff yet. And, you know, trying to put out resources to help people during this time is really, really good, but we're all kind of just on uncharted territory. And I just want to be present to listen what organizations are needing and centering that, and then kind of develop content to go forward. You know, next month I'm focusing a lot on being inclusively during COVID. And so, like, some of the questions I'm kind of throwing out there are, you know, how are organizations creating opportunities to listen to their employees right now? And then, you know, what are they doing with the information? And then, you know, thinking about crisis response communications. I talk a lot about kind of measures for success of this work, and not everything is completely cut and dry measurable, but there is a lot that is. I think moving forward, we're going to have a lot of potential to have, you know, what I call a responsive category for measuring these efforts. So trauma-informed readiness efforts is what I call this. So this is really going to spark a need to have, you know, crisis response plans, you know, empathetic layoff plans, and, you know, communication plans for when these external injustices are happening, you know, like what happened, you know, with the violence and the shootings. You know, our employees are going to want to know that our leaders are there for them and have, you know, are communicating to them and holding space for them. So I think I've been hearing this, that it's kind of a confusing potential of what could come from this. You know, in many ways, like, life will never be the same. And I kind of hope so. I kind of hope we can shed some of the stuff that we don't need anymore after going through this. But yeah, personally, I'm feeling optimistic. I'm feeling like I have a lot of time to really perfect my offering and make it as relevant as possible for when we do come out on the other side of this.
Yeah, we have slightly under 3 minutes left. And so I had a few more questions for you, but we're not going to get to them. So we'll have to do another show, you know, sometime down the road maybe. But I think it was Uber. Yeah, it was Uber laid off 3,500 people this week on Zoom, and they were doing like 3 minute calls, right? And, you know, ordinarily I would kind of roast them for that decision, but in this circumstance, I mean, I think I would have allotted more than 3 minutes, but, you know, in this circumstance, that, you know, that's probably the best they could do, and at least they didn't just send an email. You know, it doesn't mean we lower our standards, but, you know, when we're talking about empathy and stuff, I think the speed and the pressure of trying to respond and make decisions, you know, we're really under the gun, and it makes it hard to do these things, you know, in the way with some of the values that you hold for work. Anyway, that's more of a comment than a question. With our last couple minutes, any final thought, which would give you about a minute for that, and then we'll find out where people can reach out to you.
Final thoughts, really. I love sharing resources that have helped me. I really appreciate your first question, you know, of our conversation about actionable DEI. I'd be happy to share a couple resources that have helped me, if we have time for that. Just kind of authors and kind of other thought leaders that folks get really immersed in this stuff. And maybe we can leave that in the show notes too, but I'll call it out here. Ijeoma Oluwa is an author I look up to highly, and a lot of her work informs mine. And her book, So You Want to Talk About Race, I can't recommend this book enough. If you're new to having conversations about race and justice work, this is the best place to start. Another one, Lily Zhang, she is kind of a role model for me. She is over on the West Coast here, and writes a lot for Harvard Business, and also leads kind of a similar business. You can find her on LinkedIn, and she puts amazing content out there. And then finally, Paloma Medina. She is based here in Portland. She talks a lot about the neuroscience of inclusion. And so I think I mentioned her a little bit earlier. Her TED Talk just really beautifully articulates equity and why it belongs in this work too. So just wanted to amplify a few of those other amazing thought leaders that inspire my work.
The live feed's going to end right now, like in 1 second. But go ahead and share if you would, if you have any social media or your website, any of that kind of stuff, because most folks will listen to this on the download anyway, and they'll be able to go to your website. So go ahead and share that if you would.
Sure. My website, katiezink.co, and you can find me on LinkedIn, Katie Zink. And on my website, I've got a scorecard you can download to help measure collective success in your organization, and that'll walk through some of the things I focus on. And then you can join my newsletter. You can find that on my website too. I highly recommend kind of staying current with me that way.
Okay. And it's K-A-T-I-E if you're looking for Katie Zink, not K-A-T-Y. So that'll help you get there. Katie, thanks for being our guest today. It was fun to talk to you, and it went by like in a second.
These
shows tend to do that. We've been doing hour-long shows, so this kind of overwhelmed me a little bit as well. But great content, and appreciate a chance to get to know you. Stay in touch, and hopefully this will be a good show for you. Thanks for being our guest.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Michael.
I'm going to go ahead and end the episode. Everyone have a great week, and we will talk to you next week. Thanks, Katie. Have a great day. Bye.
Bye.